The second case for oral argument this morning, the Eichens Appellants versus Wayne Township Appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Aaron Solberg, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Doug Diebert, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Solberg, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
If it may please the court, counsel, my name is Aaron Solberg and I represent the Eichens. We're here today because the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department responded to the Eichens' call for help concerning a house fire. They had called the Sioux Falls Fire Department off, a professional firefighting unit. They had showed up to this fire without a ladder, without an axe, without a working saw, and without a pumper truck that worked. Now, after the Eichens fixed the pumper truck for them, they ran out of water and couldn't get more because they had put a truck in the ditch. Now, there's the facts are nightmarish, and I won't go through all of them, but there's two issues that we're here to have you consider today, and the first is the trial court's dismissal of the Eichens case for failure to prosecute under South Dakota Codified Law 15641B. The other issue is the trial court's previous dismissal of some of the Eichens' claims on summary judgment motion under 15656.
You know, it seems that the facts do raise an interesting question. And let's assume just for a minute that, the facts are so bad that the Wayne Township did just about everything that it could to result in the loss of this fire. But it raises this question, which is the heart of this lawsuit. Then why wasn't it pushed? Why wasn't it prosecuted? Why wasn't it pushed on with acceleration?
We have two factors here. First was the dismissal of four out of the five theories of the Eichens' claims on summary judgment. After that, all that remained was the theories based on the training and the status of the equipment that they had brought out. The major factor was Attorney Wassum's health. He had been diagnosed with prostate cancer in January of 2004. The last communication from Attorney Dick Johnson was in February of 2004. Mr. Wassum was the lead attorney, according to the Eichens. He's the one that they contacted. He's the one they communicated with. Dick Johnson did copy him on information. From my client's standpoint, he was running the show.
But when you say from your client's standpoint, what about from the record standpoint? Because as I see it, all the letters are going to Mr. Johnson, not Mr. Wassum.
Yeah, that's true, Your Honor.
Don't we have to decide this case from the record, not from some subjective belief that Eichens may have?
We do. We're looking at how egregious the Eichens' conduct was, and if we look at the motion to dismiss, Attorney Johnson himself states that the Eichens had no responsibility in any of the delays. To his credit, he comes out and makes that statement very, very clear at the motion.
Don't we impute the attorney's delays to the client? Otherwise, I mean, we could have cases that sit for decades, and the clients can be completely innocent, thinking that the lawyers are doing something and the lawyers are doing nothing.
The difference here is that this is a statement against interest. I believe that Mr. Johnson is exposing himself by making a statement like that. It's the one fact that I haven't seen in the other cases where the acts of the attorney are imputed to the client. He came out.
Well, by the dismissal of the case, aren't they always imputed to the client because it's the client's case that gets dismissed, not the attorney's case?
They are, and it has. This is the one fact that would distinguish it. Going back to Mr. Wassum's illness, the cancer spread in early 2005, and this was he became unable to work. And as the defendants have pointed out, anyhow, he wasn't licensed to be an attorney at that point. Attorney Johnson didn't know that fact until the day of the dismissal hearing. You know, we impute that to my clients when the own attorney didn't, when one of the attorneys didn't know that fact. There's two cases that I need to distinguish, speaking about Mr. Johnson or Wassum's illness. The first one's Reed versus Heath. That's set out in detail in the defendant's brief. However, that case is decided solely based upon South Dakota Codified Law 15-11-11, not 15-6-41-B, as this matter is dismissed under. In Reed, the attorneys in that case were in the same firm. Here, Mr. Wassum, Mr. Johnson weren't in the same firm. In that case, no transcript was provided showing the effects of the attorney's illness on its representation of the clients. Here, again, the defendants have pointed out that Wassum wasn't even licensed at that point. We have an affidavit from the motion to dismiss from Attorney Wassum stating that he couldn't work, stating that...
When did he give up his license in relation to that?
I believe it was at the end of 2004.
Which was how soon before the dismissal for lack of prosecution?
The dismissal for the prosecution was in August of 2005, so it would have been approximately 8 months.
But what about this? As I understand the record, in the trial court's findings, Wassum's illness was never disclosed to defense counsel or the court until the August 26 affidavit of 2005. And no motion for continuance or substitution of counsel was ever requested because of Mr. Wassum's health.
It appears that everybody was kept uninformed about Mr. Wassum's health, including Dick Johnson. I mean, he knew something was going on, but he didn't know that Mr. Wassum wasn't licensed at the time of the hearing. Again, Johnson steps up to the plate and takes responsibility for it.
Can you go through what your clients actually did to prosecute this case in the time frame?
In January, Mr. Wassum, Mr. Johnson, in January 2005, within 8 months, they met with a fireman, a potential expert. They hired him as an expert. They met with him in January of 2005. In February of 2005, they received national firefighting standards from him, and that had become an issue at that point after the summary judgment issue. Previous to this, Mr. Johnson had made a communication to Mr. Dibert in writing.
What date was that?
The request for offer to settle was 18 months prior to the motion to dismiss.
It was, okay, and that's the last communication then?
It was on February of 2004, 1 month after Mr. Wassum became ill.
And then was there an answer?
There was an answer. It was flat rejection of Mr. Johnson's.
In that same time frame?
Correct.
What is our standard of review now for this? This is a rule. This was a dismissal under Rule 41. Is that right?
41B, Your Honor. Yes.
What standard of review do we use?
Clearly erroneous. This was a dismissal on the merits. It was a.
And what do you know? What's your authority for that? I'm looking at Rule 41 and all his. Our rule is pretty much the same as the federal rule, and all the federal courts that have looked at this all say it's an abuse of discretion standard. Why would it be different? Why would we have a different standard in South Dakota?
Here we're reviewing the findings of fact. When we review the findings of fact, under Hoyton, which was a motion to dismiss under 41B, we determine whether their error as a matter of law, under the clearly erroneous standard. Under the clearly erroneous standard, when upon reviewing the entire evidence, the findings, if the court's left with a definite, firm conviction that the trial court has erred, it can reverse the trial court's decision.
Were there facts that you're alleging here that are clearly erroneous? You're not complaining about what the court found as facts. You're complaining that the court's decision was wrong, aren't you?
Correct, and the court laid out 77 facts supporting.
All right, but I mean, are you alleging that some of those facts were found to be incorrect, or are you alleging that those facts don't add up to a grounds for dismissal?
We're advocating that the facts don't add up to dismissal, Your Honor.
All right, and so that's a different issue than whether the findings are correct or right, isn't it? I mean, isn't that something we should look at under the standard of review of abuse of discretion? Because we're asking ourselves, do these facts justify what the judge did?
I understand, Your Honor. The facts in this case, there's 77 findings of fact, and they're so intertwined with the conclusions of law are built right into some of the facts, whether actions were egregious. I've strenuously objected to, twice objected to the findings of fact, filed a motion to refuse to consider the motions of fact, based that most of them were evidentiary. I have made several issues with the findings of fact, and that's why, Your Honor, I'm advocating the clearly erroneous standard. I understand where you're coming from.
Well, give us an example of one fact that the court found that's wrong.
That Mr. Johnson's or Mr. Wassum's prostate cancer failed to explain the delay.
What's wrong with that?
The standard's egregious. Like I said, the facts and the conclusions are intertwined. The test under 41B is whether it was egregious. We look at 15.11.11 for justifiable excuse. The second case I'd like to distinguish concerning Mr. Wassum's prostate cancer was Duncan. That case was decided under 41B. The difference between that case and this case is there's a delay of 5 years in that case. The attorney in that case was only sick in the fifth year. Here we have Mr. Wassum sick from January.
Did Duncan have a healthy co-counsel like we've got here?
I believe that was the Reed case where the two attorneys were not in the same firm, and that case was decided under 15.11.11.
So when did the Wassum thing actually come up? Did that come up after 2004? After February 2004 date?
He was diagnosed with prostate cancer and began the treatment in January 2004.
Okay.
It became so bad he couldn't work after he'd been unlicensed in 2005.
So who wrote the letter to settle, request to settle?
Mr. Johnson did.
Okay, so Mr. Johnson had already taken over the case at that point.
Mr. Johnson wrote that letter 1 month after Mr. Wassum became ill.
But isn't the problem after the February 2004 date? Isn't the timing, nothing happened after that? Isn't that the problem? Isn't that what the determination on the egregiousness was after this all transpired with Wassum and Mr. Johnson had taken over?
The period is from
missing something.
No, the period of the 18-month delay that we're talking about is from February 3rd, 2004 through August 4th, 2005.
So that's an 18-month approximately. So what Let's assume that the case was prosecuted then up until this February 2004 date. Is there some, do you have a case that supports that this period between February of 2004 and the time the motion to dismiss was filed, that that isn't a long enough period to claim that it was egregious?
I do, Your Honor. I have several cases. Most of them are cited in Homo versus Bruce. That case comes out and says under 15 641B, no cases have been dismissed for less a delay than 3 to 4 years, and it cites several, including the Duncan case, which was dismissed after 5 years, Potts after 8 years, Fox, it was over 4 years in Fox, and Watkins, it was over 3 years in Watkins. The egregious standard of 41B, according to these cases, we haven't reached that level because we haven't hit the 3 to 4 years. The other cases cited by defense counsel, such as White Eagle, Annette, Dakota Cheese, DeVitt, and Reed, those cases were decided under 15-11-11 solely. The other case, there's another set of cases.
Are you arguing to this court that all you have to do to fend off of a 41B motion is pop in a letter every year or so to the opposing counsel and that starts the clock over?
Absolutely not. We have Mr. Wasson's illness is a factor.
But by then he was already not an attorney, wasn't he? Hadn't he lost his license by the time the prostate cancer gets diagnosed? So really, that makes his illness irrelevant. He's not an attorney anyway.
He had been able to work on it. We don't know from the record why he lost his license, if he could have recovered it, how he could have helped, if he could have served in some other capacity for Johnson. The fact that Mr. Johnson didn't know that he had lost his license is a factor we'd ask for you to consider. Certainly not advocating popping an attorney every year to keep a case, delaying case. What I'm advocating is there's two different tests for 15-11-11 and 41B. The egregiousness, it's a motion brought up by the defendant. The circuit or the trial court in this matter certainly had the option to manage its calendar under the 11 rule. It didn't do so. I think we have to respect its decision not to do so. It had the file in front of it. It could have.
Oh, wait a minute, though. We're not going to try to justify your delay on the trial court's failure to issue a scheduling order or a 15-11-11 motion, are you? You're not suggesting that justifies the conduct here, are you?
A scheduling order was requested at the motion.
I don't mean a scheduling order. I mean the 11-11 motion to dismiss. That, because the trial court failed to do that, that doesn't justify your predecessor's conduct, does it?
We have two statutes. The application of one or the other, they're two statutes with completely different tests. The court did have the option to do that test. We can't assume why he didn't do that. I don't think I'm blaming it on the court. More so paying respect to his decision not to dismiss under the 15-11-11. He left it up to defense counsel to show that this conduct was egregious. The test we're looking at today, rather than looking at merely a one-year record delay, and all we're asking the court to do is look at the court's decision, the trial court's decision, in that light. We talked about a set of cases about the time frame involved in this, the delay. I see that I'm almost out of time. The third set of cases that have been decided on 41B and 11. The one thing that the common theme through all those is that there was a court order, a violation of the court order by the plaintiffs, or discovery violation of rules of discovery. For example, in Janko, there was a 30-month delay after the trial court had ordered the plaintiff to get an attorney. I also believe that there was a discovery order violation in that as well. We look at those cases. Schwartz, there's a failure to follow a court order. Storm, it looks like it was decided under 15.6.37b. Again, that's plaintiff ignored a court order and discovery in that matter.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Dibert, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices, may it please this court, Mr. Salbert. I'm Douglas Dibert of Sioux Falls. I have the privilege of representing Wayne Township in this unfortunate matter, of course, that involved a fire caused by an electrical fault, Veterans Day of 1998, nearly 9 years ago, and the fact that during a raging blizzard, the fire department was unable to control the fire, largely because of the lack of a continuous water source, meaning fire hydrants. They had to figure out a way to haul water and simply didn't get the job done. The chronology, I think, is quite clear. And one comment, I went through this in some detail, not just the 18 months of inactivity, but in my affidavit at Index 282, much of which was adopted by the, or rather in the trial court's findings, that after the case was sued, some short written discovery was exchanged. After some number of letters, we finally reached a stipulation on the entry of a scheduling order with an expert identified June 29th of 2002. That's the first real substantive thing that happened. After some number of additional letters from me, we finally got the expert deposed in September of 2002, the second thing that happened. After some more letters, I finally was able to depose the plaintiff in November of 2002, third thing. Now, from November of 2002 until July of 2003, nothing happened, not a letter from anyone, 8 months of delay. And what I'm doing here, I know that didn't exceed a year, but just to show the overall flavor of this case in the significant amount of time it was in suit.
Is there any indication there was some activity going on that wouldn't necessarily precipitate a letter to you?
There wasn't, Justice Meyer, Henry, and I'm quite sure that my affidavit was complete. That affidavit is index 282. It was never challenged both at the hearing at the circuit court level or neither a proceeding before this court. So I don't think there was. One other thing that I noticed going through these, if you look at it was finding 76, and that involved a letter from me as well, Joel Wassum was an inactive member of the bar in calendar year 2003 for reasons I don't know either. But thus, by my count, that 12 months plus the eight months in 2005, Wassum was not an active member of the South Dakota bar. And I think it's somewhat between an overstatement and something incorrect to suggest that Johnson at the last minute, quote, stepped up to the plate, unquote. I think that's quite apparent from the record that Johnson signed the initial pleadings, Johnson responded to the motion for summary judgment, Johnson was on all the letters, and again, looking at finding 76, as of July of 2003, when I had noted that Wassum was an inactive member of the bar, I quit copying Wassum on the correspondence. So the idea that Wassum was a lead counsel, I think, is really incorrect. And by the way, finding 72 did find that Johnson was lead counsel under either clearly erroneous or abusive discretion or any other test. I believe the record is very clear that finding is proper. Johnson was lead counsel on the case.
Is there any indication that the Ishams had anything to do with this delay rather than just the attorneys? Let's assume.
No, Justice.
They were just sitting there waiting, assuming their attorneys were working on their case, and all of a sudden it gets dismissed.
That very well may be, Justice Meyer Henry. And of course, as was pointed out, in any kind of case, I don't care if it's a dismissal under the statute of limitations, a motion such as this, or some motion that the lawyer forgets about or does a poor job on, the lawyer is responsible for that. This court has recognized that, and it just occurred to me there was the federal land bank case from, I think, 1976, having to do with the theory that the attorney has the authority to settle a case. So once again, it may be unfortunate that the sins of the attorney are, so to speak, visited upon the client, but I believe that's the way it is.
What about this, the two things that were mentioned by Mr. Salberg, that they met with an expert in January of 2005 and they received the National Firefighters Standard in February of 2005? Does that do anything to tolling that time frame?
I don't believe so, Justice Meyer Henry. For one thing, the scheduling order from June of 2002 provided a deadline of June 30, 2002 for the expert deadline. They disclosed June 29th. I suspect the reason they were looking for a new expert was when I deposed the expert in Des Moines in September of 2002, he was totally discredited because he thought there was a light snow going on. If you'll recall from these first proceedings, when I gave him the correct hypothesis, that is 50-mile-an-hour winds, 13 inches of snow in about 9 hours, zero visibility, his exact testimony was, quote, well, that's a whole different ballgame. It, meaning the house, is going to be a total loss. The other comment, Justice Meyer Henry, is under Homo versus Royce, I think it's quite clear from prior decisions of this court that unilateral action, in that case between the attorney and his client, did not constitute activity to defeat a motion such as this.
Was here, that 11, though, under 11 rather than 41?
You're correct, but I don't believe that's a distinction with a difference as far as looking at the...
You can dismiss under 11 without egregious conduct.
I'll take that as correct. I can't recall that, Justice.
I think.
At any rate, Homo versus...
We decided that, but maybe we didn't.
Homo versus Royce made it very clear that unilateral activity here between this expert and counsel does not constitute activity. Besides that, as I mentioned, apparently the only thing that... Mr. Durban came up with some kind of national standards. Well, that was hardly a state secret either, in that those standards are as accessible as the Uniform Building Code, the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, ASHTO, I mean, the whole alphabet soup, and there's nothing to indicate that that opinion is going to lead anywhere. So, Justice Meyer Henry, for those reasons, I would urge that claimed activity was not, in fact, activity consistent with the statutes and the cases decided by this court.
Do you claim your client suffered any prejudice as a result of the delay?
The fire department was disbanded several years ago. Quite frankly, I've had no contact. I think that may constitute prejudice, but nonetheless, Justice, I think it's clear from the prior cases of this court. One of them being Dakota Cheese.
I've been down that road. So.
All right.
Thanks.
It's not necessary. Further, as I urged in my brief, if this court were to make that change, that is to require prejudice consistent with the Minnesota statute, that it be done statute first by rule of court and then statutorily, as was the change to 15-11-11 defining activity.
But I think our rule is the same as the federal rule, and I think the federal courts, many of the federal courts say there has to be some prejudice, maybe not actual prejudice, but some prejudice.
Justice Konenkamp, I'm really not familiar with those. Quite frankly, in the federal sphere, those cases come up so seldom now with the very tight Rule 16 scheduling orders, resulting from the Form 35 report right from the first 30 days. So I'm not familiar with that.
As the moving party, it's your burden to show what? That the delay was unreasonable? Is that right? Or what is your burden?
I think my burden is to show that the trial court's findings were not an abuse of discretion, were not clearly erroneous, that the record upholds the idea that the delay was egregious.
So it's not unreasonable. I think that some courts use unreasonable. You're saying so egregious would be something more serious than an unreasonable? Is that?
I don't know. And in my brief, I addressed the definition of egregious. Egregious doesn't mean anything evil or nasty. It's at page 18 of my my brief. The definition I took from one of the dictionaries was it's notably bad, flagrant, significant, remarkable, striking, or conspicuous. I think any of those adjectives apply. So I think conclusion six was correct, that this was egregious. And throughout all this, it strikes me that there has never been an explanation why nothing happened for months and months and months through any of these of this chronology, and in particular the 18 months from February of 04 to August of 05. And I can't help but wonder if I hadn't made the motion in August of 05, how much time would have gone by? Another 6 months? I don't know. But Justice Kornkamp, I think under those facts and that definition, this was egregious. And if we have a burden now, that we met that.
You're going back to Justice Saber's question on prejudice. Did you offer any evidence on prejudice, an affidavit to indicate? I know you mentioned that the fire department's all the personnel are gone or the fire department's disbanded, but did you offer any evidence on that issue?
I did not, Justice Kornkamp. Frankly, I didn't think I needed to, but I, for whatever reason, I did not.
Okay. Mr. Divert, your case, your brief and case presents something we've never done before. You've pointed out a number of delays throughout this several years that this went on. And we've never aggregated delays before. I'd like you to just step back from your advocate role in this case, not trying to win or lose this particular case, but from a fairness perspective, from both plaintiff and defense counsel, what do you see as the wisdom of aggregating conduct in a case like this and considering the delay?
First of all, I don't believe there was any aggregating regarding the 18 months of uncontroverted inactivity. From February of 04 to August of 05, plaintiff's counsel have never claimed that they sent a letter, made a phone call, or anything else. In fact, finding 72 mentioned that there was not a phone call, an interrogatory, a deposition, or anything in the time this case was in suit. So the aggregating delays, I think Justice Zinner was pointed out in the context of my mentioning that the difficulty we had to get to any step we got to, the number of letters to get a scheduling order, to get a deposition, to get the second deposition of plaintiff, and then the 8 months for a motion, we're not aggregating in the sense of trying to come up with 1 year, because we certainly have 18 months of uncontroverted evidence there was no activity.
I understand that, but so how should we as a court deal with these other delays that you have brought up?
I don't think it's necessary.
Should we aggregate them or should we not? Should we?
Again, in this case, I don't think you need to reach that simply because.
You're not going to answer my question.
I guess, it's one of those things I don't have an answer for. I had anticipated several questions. That wasn't one of them, and I think that's the best I can do, Justice Inter.
That's fine. Thanks.
Some issue was made of the distinction between 1511 and 15641. I don't believe it matters. And I can't remember what it was at argument last year that led to this, but one of the things that's involved here is the statute of limitations ran in November of 04. Thus, even if this had been a 15-11-11 proceeding generated in August of 05 or any other time, the dismissal would have been with prejudice as opposed to without because the statute had run. There's also a remark made in the brief of appellants that seems to indicate that because the court didn't sua sponte initiate a 15-11-11 proceeding, somehow that taints the fact that we brought the motion under 15-641B. Well, the fact of the matter is, the circuit court judges and clerks are awfully busy, particularly in Minnehaha County, I think, and certainly the defense under 15-641B has the right to bring that motion under that statute. We can't bring the motion under 15-11-11, so that distinction, I think, is a distinction without a real difference. Whether abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous, looking at the Dakota Cheese case at page 715, there's a great definition of abuse of discretion. It has been defined by this court as a decision which is not justified by and clearly against reason and evidence. Well, that's certainly not the case here. Another sentence, it has been defined by this court as not justified by, clearly against reason and evidence, and this court will not reverse a decision if we believe a judicial mind, in view of the law and circumstances, could reasonably have reached that conclusion. So we believe we've met that test. If the test is clearly erroneous, under Deadwood versus Summit, this court has defined clearly erroneous as when, after a review of all the evidence, and that is the chronology here and particularly the 18 months, we are left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made.
Have we, in your research, been inconsistent in our standards applied to Rule 41, or?
I don't believe you have at all.
You're just covering all the bases.
Covering all the bases, partly because of the 15-11-11 argument, 15-641, and then 15-652, since findings of fact were made here.
But it seems like wouldn't you still look at the findings of fact under clearly erroneous? And then, of course, if none of them are clearly erroneous, then you look at, based on those facts, whether it was abuse of discretion to dismiss it. And it seems like it's a combination of the two when there's a factual finding.
I agree with that, Justice Meyer-Henry. And again, under all these facts, much of it being that, unfortunate as Mr. Wassum's illness was and apparently is, that had nothing to do with the delay here. At least it doesn't excuse it. Much of that reason being he wasn't an active member of the bar in 03 or in 05. I don't believe I have any other remarks. Again, regrettable as this matter, as it is, to be in the position of bringing a motion such as this. It is a defense to be raised, just as contributory negligence, assumption of risk, or anything else. I made the motion I believe was proper. I think the two statutes are clear. The prior decisions of this court are very clear. The trial court was neither clearly erroneous, nor did it abuse its discretion in dismissing this case, and we would urge the trial court's decision be affirmed.
One question. Was there ever any reason given for the delay? Was there ever any reason for the explanation for the delay?
If there is, Justice Sabers, and I've sort of challenged that in briefs and argument, I don't know what it was. And I think I argued that I have not heard yet why in 18 months an interrogatory couldn't have been served, a substitution of counsel, a motion for an amended scheduling order, or anything else. And as finding 72 the court mentions all the things that were not done. Justice Sabers, I'm unaware of any explanation for that delay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davey.
Thank you.
Mr. Salberg, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Is it possible that the delay in this case was that there just wasn't a good cause of action here, and that the attorneys were stumped on how they really were going to proceed on this case with any kind of hope of succeeding?
To speculate, I could say yes, but I don't want to speculate as to why the case was.
But isn't that the reason then for a 41B motion?
After the sovereign immunity, or the motion for summary judgment on sovereign immunity, only a couple theories of law remained, or a couple theories of recovery remained.
What were those?
The adequacy of the equipment and the training of the volunteer fire department. Again, they had showed up without a ladder, without an axe. It's quite well set out in my brief. If there's one thing that I could leave you with today, is that if the defendants have shown absolutely no prejudice. It is true that the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department disbanded, and that was in 2004. However, in this case, we don't have one single fact showing that anybody died, anybody moved away, or that any evidence at all has been lost or destroyed. one of the prior questions asked in fairness, stand back answer a question from the advocating role. In that sense, there's no purpose to dismiss this. If there were, the trial court could have used 15-11-11 as a house cleaning mechanism. They didn't do that. Again, I'm saying that out of respect for the trial court's decision.
Well, as you sit here today, based on the state of the record, how close are you to going to trial? This looks like it's barely out of the blocks.
There have been depositions taken. There have been affidavits served. If honestly, if I were going to take this to trial, I believe that a few more depositions may need to be had. Interrogatory responses were served upon Mr. Dybert. It's not as if no discovery occurred in this matter at all. Mr. Woodland, the defendant's expert, as we all know, can testify about hypotheticals. At the time, perhaps he wasn't prepared for the hypothetical that he was given. I don't believe, as Mr. Dybert said, that he was discredited. Was he strong? Well, I'm not going to comment on that. I think it's obvious from the record. Judge Teedy commented on Mr. Woodland. I believe it's a matter of preparation, Your Honor. The smaller delays in this matter, we look at those, it's a matter of aggregation. It's a matter of the defense not having the litigation move at its pace. Now, was it prompt as we'd like? Maybe not, but the deposition that Mr. Dybert requested that did occur, the summary judgment motion that he had scheduled did occur. to come back now and to say, you know, especially when there's no prejudice about them, and they have happened, to add those to the mix, to add them to the 18-month delay, is just certainly unfair to the plaintiffs.
But don't the cases in this court require some reason given, some reason for some explanation for the delay? I mean, in other words, if you go all the way to the end with completely unexplained delay, aren't you out of court?
Under 11, you need an excuse. Under 41B, the conduct needs to be egregious. Again, we turn back to the time frame. The time frame alone, even if we aggregated them, wouldn't add up to that 3 years, wouldn't add up to that 4 years. We don't believe that this case is egregious. We'd ask this court to remand this matter back to the trial court so that my clients can have their day in court. And if there's no more questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. No one's ever chastised for quitting early. We will be in recess. Because we run on the internet, we have to start on the hour, so we will be in recess until 11 o'clock.